Reviewer David Levitt has written that Jane Smiley is not a writer anyone could ever accuse of getting stuck in a rut. Over the past few years, she has produced, among other things, a murder mystery, a 500-page saga of 14th-century Greenland, a handful of extremely well-crafted short stories, and a novella collectively called The Age of Grief, two more novellas, Ordinary Love and Goodwill, and in there somewhere, a nonfiction work on the craftspeople of the Catskills. Today, a conversation with a woman of broad reach, professor and author Jane Smiley, on Conversations. From KUAC FM in Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis. You do, as David Levitt said, seem to cut this lovely broad swath as a writer. And I found myself wondering when I was reading from your works whether this is something you do by putting yourself inside the characters, inside the story, finding that, locating that place for them inside yourself and then moving forward? Or is there another place, is there some place that you go where you can go so entirely into the subject and the style in which you're writing?
Well, mostly I think it's that I'm an inveterate listener to what other people have to say, stories that they tell, and I always swipe them. And I'll get interested in something, that some little anecdote that someone has told me, and it'll start me out, and I'll want to know more about that. And so maybe it's that my own mind is sort of blank, you know, I don't know what it is, but it's very impressionable, and pretty soon I'm out there somewhere where I had never thought I was going to be, and it's just a life of a sort of active imagination. And I live in Ames, Iowa, which is maybe the quintessential blank spot, and it's easy to project your imagination onto the world there because it's very flat, and there's not a lot of visual stimulation. And so your own imagination gets a lot of scope.
But it's between your ears. I had decided when reading The Age of Grief, this is a novella that Jane Smiley has put out with a group of short stories as well. They're collectively called The Age of Grief. David, the dentist, is describing his children. He says he has decided that each of his children comes into life through a different sense. Lizzie, the eldest, through her eyes, and Stephanie, the middle child, through her ears, and Leah, the baby, it connects with the world through touch, tactily. Mm-hmm. And when I read that, I decided that you must connect visually, because so much of what you write is, it seems to me, so attentive to detail, but it's aural. That's interesting.
Well, most of my memories are visual. I can always remember what something looked like or what the light was like when we were traveling at a certain spot. But artistically, I'm more attracted to music than painting. So I don't know exactly which of my senses is the most well-developed. I think that's something you can see in your children that you can't see in yourself. Mm. Because you're just so accustomed to your own way of broaching the world. I have bad eyes, and I don't know what that means, but I'm sure it has some effect on my sense of the world. I'm not very observant. My husband is much more observant than I am, and yet I always get a strong sort of global impression of the light where I am, and then I retained that for a long time.
When you were talking about stealing snatches of conversation, stealing what you hear, the stories, mm-hmm. taking them is probably more polite.
Sometimes I ask permission. Sometimes I ask that they be given to me.
Good. How do you decide into what context? And I'm thinking about the work that takes place in contemporary time, because some of your work does not, as we'll talk about. How do you decide whether it's going to be a mystery novel or a story of two lovers? Or
I think a lot of that is instinctive. I mean, when someone tells me an anecdote that strikes me, often I have an instinctive response to it. And other people tell me anecdotes that I enjoy, but that I don't have any desire to claim. And I have some friends whose lives I'm continuously raiding, and other friends who are equally interesting, whose lives are totally safe from my raids for some reason. I don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. I think every writer has a particular affinity for a certain point of view. An anecdote or a story that someone tells them will demonstrate that point of view in some way. I have one friend who's Swedish on both sides all the way back, and stories in her family are always showing up in my work because I think they express a very Scandinavian sort of resignation to that is almost cruel. So I'm a modern enough, American enough person to find some of the things that have happened in her family astounding, but they also seem vaguely familiar, you know, so and quite moving. So I think that's true of every writer. Every writer is, they just, some stories they like and some stories they need. Mm.
We're talking today with Jane Smiley. Let's turn to the Greenlanders. The motivation for this story, did it, am I right, began in a medieval archaeological dig in Europe that you worked on after graduating from Vassar?
Well, I had taken... I think the motivation to tell the story began when I was a child, and I had a strong sense of, strong fear of atomic war and the end of life, and that was something I was very preoccupied with as a child. And then when I was in Iceland on a Fulbright, and I just sort of discovered the Greenlanders and how they'd lived on the southern tip of Greenland for 450 or almost 500 years, I thought, gee, they really underwent the end of their civilization. They really did see the apocalypse, and so that's the subject for me.
Tell us a little bit about their lives so that people know. How did they see the end of their civilization? How did it come about?
Well, there have been a lot of theories about how it came about, and the theories are sort of like dinosaur theories. They tell more about the age in which they're formulated than they do about actually the end of the particular civilization. But, for example, in the 1930s, the archaeologists all thought that they'd had some kind of racial decline. And then it was felt later that that wasn't true. And then in the 50s, it was felt that there was some kind of climatic disintegration. It got too cold for them. But in fact, when it did get cold, and it did in the middle of the 14th and into the 15th centuries, it got colder and more Arctic in Greenland. The sea mammals came down from the north, and they formed the Greenlanders were used to hunting the sea mammals, so in fact, when they came down farther, it was easier to hunt them, and their diets were probably better in terms of calories and protein. What I thought after doing a lot of reading in Icelandic literature was that the same sort of internal stress bred by feuding was probably at work in Greenland as it was in Iceland and as it is in Sicily. Everywhere that the Vikings went, they carried this predisposition to feud until so many people had died that everybody said, gee, we can't go on any longer. And I thought that probably that was exacerbated by stress, and so that there would be internal and external pressures on the Greenland colony. The other thing about them, which I think people in Alaska can probably understand quite well, is that there were four or five smaller colonies kind of far-flung in Greenland, and they depended on good communications and relatively easy transport to do things together and as a whole group. They would go on seal hunts as a group twice a year. They would trade breeding stock for sheep and cows and goats. And they would also gather at the cathedral, and they would go on egg gathering parties together. And as a group, all of these little clusters, if they got together and did these few ritual things once a year, then that helped them all as a group to sustain themselves. But once each individual little colony no longer had the boats or no longer had the horses or no longer had even the energy, you might say, to meet and go on the seal hunts and to trade breeding stock and to formulate laws, then each little cluster out away from the cathedral would not have the wherewithal to sustain itself for very long. And there's a lot of evidence that there was maritime activity, European maritime activity in the North Atlantic in the 15th century. The Basques were fishing off the Grand Banks, and pirates from England were also going out into the North Atlantic. So there's an Eskimo or an Inuit legend of very strange-looking men with metal faces in big wooden boats coming to Greenland and doing the thing that white men were always known for by the Inuit, which is killing each other. And so I think it's a fairly good guess to say that there were pirates from Bristol who came to Greenland and who, when they got there, ravaged whatever they could see, whatever was close to enough to the water to be stolen or destroyed. And that probably broke the links, the last links between the various little colonies. And so after that, it would take them maybe a few winters to run through their own resources, and then that would be it.
Can you read for us?
Oh, sure.
Section of this story that you picked out, we can get some more connection with these people.
Okay. One of the most fascinating things to me was to discover not how the Greenlanders died, but to discover how they lived all through the Middle Ages. And one of the things that they did fairly often, more often than you think, was to go to America, because there were certain resources that they just didn't have in Greenland. One of them was wood, and one of them was iron smelting. So they would go to Nova Scotia, where they had a little base camp, you might say, and they might spend a summer there trapping furs and cutting wood and smelting some iron. And the last recorded example of one of these trips was in 1348, when 18 men in a rowboat went from Greenland to America. And they got there and they did fine, and then, but on the way home they were blown off course. So I turned this little incident, which is an entry in the Icelandic annals, since they were blown to Iceland, to a story. And so this is the story that I wrote about this incident.
Jane Smiley reading from The Greenlanders.
There was a Greenlander named Oscar Ospaksson who had come to Greenland from Iceland as a small boy. For his father was a poor man in Iceland, and in addition to that, had received a sentence of lesser outlawry for attacking a wealthy man. Ospak saw that there was little for him in Iceland, so he came to Greenland, thinking to take to hunting in the North Seder and make himself a wealthy man. And so he had done so, bringing his son Oscar, but leaving behind his wife. And Ospak and Oscar lived in Greenland for some 15 summers, mostly in the western settlement, which was closer to the North Seder. And Ospach was not a bad hunter, and Oscar was not either, although he was hardly so good as he thought himself, for no man could be. These men had one great advantage, and that was that they had had the foresight to bring with them many iron weapons, swords and spears and crossbows with iron-tipped arrows. Indeed, Ospach had sold off his patrimony for these weapons, and they were the making of him. Now it happened, when Oscar was some 25 winters old, that Ospach grew ill and died suddenly one winter, and Oscar was left alone. And he found just how much he was lacking, as men do when they have only one companion and that companion dies. So Oscar went to the assembly of the western settlement in search of a wife, but none of the girls was to Oscar's liking. And so he took his boat, which was an open boat he had built himself from driftwood found in the North Seder, and he rowed to the eastern settlement where the thing had already broken up. But he was a man of some resourcefulness, and he carried with him a stock of fine goods from the North Seder. These would be things like furs and walrus tusks and any Arctic mammal products. And he used these goods to gain himself hospitality at all the best houses in Brattahlid and Vatnajökull districts, and at Herjolfsnes as well. And he saw many good-looking young women. After the winter had gone by, he looked within his heart, and he saw there that his fancy was for a young woman named Adni, who was the daughter of the wealthiest man in Herjolfsnes. And, of course, she thought little of him, for the Herjolfsnes folk are very proud, refined, and outlandish, and look more to Norway and France than they do to the western settlement for the things they desire. Now this fellow Oscar was very importunate, so much so that Adni lost patience and told her father that he had to do something to rid her of this hairy fellow. Adni's father, who was a man named Kalf, feared to offend such an unpredictable fellow as Oscar, so he made him a vow that if he would do something that he had never done before to prove that he was indeed the best hunter in Greenland, he would give him Adni's hand. Oscar asked what this thing might be, and Kalf declared that it would be to go to Markland and bring goods back from there for Adni's bridal gift. That would be Labrador and Nova Scotia, Markland was. For as valued as Greenland goods were in Norway at that time, so much more so were goods from Markland. But Kalf knew that there were no ships in Greenland, as none had come at that time in about 3 years, and so he expected that this would be an impossible task, and he and Adni were confident that they would now be rid of the northerner. This was at the end of winter, during Lent, and after hearing these words, Oscar went off and was not heard of for a while, and the folk at Herjolfsnes were pleased enough at that. But then the summer began, and it was just time for the seal hunt, and shortly after the seal hunt was over, news came to Kalf that Oscar had persuaded 17 men to go with him in his open boat to Markland. And Kalf laughed at this and declared that Oscar had chosen death, not Adni's hand. One of these men who chose to go to Markland was Osmund Thordarson, who was then about 22 winters of age and a big, strong fellow, though not much of a hunter. He was a good rower, though, so Oscar consented to his coming, and he was the youngest fellow on the boat. Such a thing as this had never been done before, to take an open boat to Markland, and many folk considered Oscar exceptionally foolhardy, but it must be said that he had little trouble finding folk to go with him, especially folk from the west, who never lived as comfortably as folk in the east. Now it did seem that Kalf and Adni would be out of luck, for the men in the boat had exceptionally good weather and came to the forests of Markland in a very short time, some 20 days or so, with 9 men rowing half the time and the other 9 rowing the other half of the time. And when they got there, they had good hunting and no encounters with the Skraelings, which would be Native Americans, not Eskimos, but more or less North American Indians. And they got so many furs that Oscar tore the benches out of the boat and piled furs where they had been, and the men sat on these for the trip homeward. Now it happened that one night Osmund came to Oscar and said, "It seems to me that our luck is about to turn, and unless we prepare ourselves properly, We will lose all these riches that we have already counted as ours and already used to pay for many things in our mind's eye. But because Osmond was the youngest man on the voyage, Oscar merely smiled upon him and paid him little heed. Perhaps, as Osmond said, Oscar considered Adni to be his, and in his dreams he was already enjoying her. At any rate, there was little to bear out Osmond's prediction, for the good weather and the good luck held, and they cast off from Markland around the time of the Feast of Mary Magdalene, as they thought, for Oscar carried a stick calendar that he had made the previous winter. And they had good weather and rowed vigorously, and by this time Oscar was already counting his sons and daughters. After some days it happened that some of the men sighted flocks of birds off in the distance, and Oscar thought that he was close to Greenland indeed, and as Herjolf's Ness is the first stopping place in Greenland, he began to brag about how he would row into the harborage at Kalfstedting and throw the furs on the ground in front of the old man and then claim his wife. But as he was speaking, the birds all disappeared, and within moments a great storm blew up, a storm such as would swamp a ship, much less an open boat that should have been used for coasting from farmstead to farmstead among the fjords of the eastern settlement. The little boat shipped a great deal of water, and the men were often in fear of their lives. And it happened that Osmond, who was indeed prepared, raised his voice in prayer both to the Lord and the Virgin and also to St. Nicholas, who once saved a boatload of sailors and since has often interceded for them. And so Osmond rowed and prayed and prayed and rowed, and after some time the storm died down. But indeed there was no sign of land, and none of the men recognized anything, for there was nothing to recognize, only open sea and the occasional iceberg. And so they drifted and rowed for many days, and their supply of water began to run low, and with his lips now parched, Osmond raised his voice in prayer again. Now Oscar lamented his fate and began to blame Adni and declared that her hand was little worth such a trial. After a few days, when they were in great fear of their lives, they awakened one morning to discover that they had drifted within sight of land, great black cliffs and green valleys, and this land was Borgarfjord in the west of Iceland, and they were not a little glad to see it, and they took up their oars with renewed strength, though they were greatly debilitated by their journey, and they rowed into Borgarfjord. It happened that the farmer who controlled much of the land along the southern shores of Borgarfjord was a man named Elias Egilson, and he and his folk came down to the fjord to greet the newcomers. And when Elias Egilson, the Icelander, saw the open boat, he was not a little amazed at the journey the Greenlanders had undertaken, and he doubted their words. But when Oscar in his brash way began to lift out the furs he had gotten in Markland and show them off, Elias Egilson was seized by greed, for indeed he saw that the 18 Greenlanders were much weakened by hunger, and from their tale he knew that it would be assumed that they had been lost at sea. He could take the furs, which were tied up in bundles, and declare that they had washed ashore on his strand, and he therefore had the rights over them. And so he told his servants to say nothing of the coming of these visitors, but to the visitors he showed nothing but open hospitality, and all of the Greenlanders were taken in and congratulated themselves on their luck, all except Osmund Thordarson, who saw at once that Elias was planning to tempt them with food until they had eaten themselves sick and then kill them all in their beds. And so Osmond only ate a little and pretended to eat and drink more, but actually passed his meat between his legs to the dogs under the table. And the rest of the Greenlanders were greatly undone by intoxicating drink, which Greenlanders are unaccustomed to. Now all the men went to their benches for sleep, if they could indeed make it, so drunk were they, and Osmond went too and pretended to sleep, but when all was quiet he slipped out of his blankets, only bunching them up to look like a sleeping person, and he hid in a corner near the stacks of furs. Some while later, the door of the guest house opened quietly, and men entered with Elias at their head. And as Elias was tiptoeing toward Oscar with his axe raised, Osmond sank far back into the dark, put a cup with a broken-out bottom to his mouth, and let out a great howl, using the broken cup to change and draw out the music so that it sounded like the wailing of a spirit. Elias hesitated, for he was somewhat afraid of spirits. The howling stopped. The Greenlanders, far gone in drink, only shifted in their sleep. Elias raised his axe again, and Osmond began to howl again, and this time louder, as if he were calling across the fjord in the wind so loud that he thought that his voice would give out. But indeed, he howled so loudly and so inhumanly long that Elias was convinced that there was a spirit present in the room, and he dropped his axe and left. In the morning when Oscar woke up, Osman related what had happened to him, and Oscar was much put out. That evening it was apparent to everyone that Elias hoped to try again, for he pressed food and drink upon the Greenlanders with unstinting generosity. But this time all of the Greenlanders did as Osman had done and only pretended to fall over in a stupor at the proper time. They went to their sleeping benches, and when all was quiet, they moved off and gathered in the shadows around the walls of the hall and waited. When Elias and his servants entered some time later, they fell upon them and beat them, and Oscar, as a punishment, put a thong around Elias' neck and strung him up over the roof beam for a time, not killing him, but hurting him very badly. And after this, the Greenlanders were in possession of Elias' steading for the rest of the winter, and it happened that the next spring, Oscar went looking for his relations in the western fjords of Scotland, of Iceland, for he was a rich man and a show-off. And he became acquainted with a wealthy widow who was a second cousin of his, and she persuaded him to stay with her in Iceland, and he did so. The others, including Osmund, took a ship to Norway, where they sold their portion of the furs and found passage back to Greenland. And after these exploits, Osmund Thordarson was a rich man with a great reputation for cleverness, and it was true that he knew the laws very well almost until the end of his life. And he later becomes the law speaker of the Greenland colony and is quite prominent.
The lost speaker.
The law speaker. It's like the person who knows what the laws are and tells them once a year so that everybody else will sort of remember them.
And does our proud protagonist gain his wife from the father?
Well, he decides this other widow in Iceland is the one for him because she's already rich.
Do we follow them throughout the story? Are there others, families, children?
This is just an anecdote that they tell. Osmund, this is an anecdote that they tell in order to say what Osmund, the law speaker, has been like and what his story is. And when we meet him in the Greenlanders, he's old and kind of on his last legs, and so they're telling this story about his youth in order to show what he once was. But the actual family that is followed in the book is not related to them, and they have other adventures. But I wanted to get this trip to America in because I thought it was so astounding. At the end of the book, there are various theories about what happened to the Greenlanders. And one of the theories was that some, but maybe more, just went to America. And there used to be a tribe of Native Americans that's now extinct called the Mandans. And in the early 19th century, when white people were first encountering the Mandan Indians, they were said to have blue eyes. And some people thought that maybe they were at least partially the descendants of a group of Greenlanders that had come in the middle of the 15th century. So there is one little incident in the book where Margaret, one of the main characters, encounters a man who says, gee, let's go to America, and then they leave and nobody knows what happens to them.
You said in an interview with Publishers Weekly, just as this book was coming out, that the people of Greenland were people who lived, experienced their agonies and passions, and then fell through a hole in history.
Mm-hmm.
When you're writing this book for people in the 1980s and 90s to read, are you also writing to talk to us about our own passions and agonies and perhaps potential hole in history? Is there anything there?
Oh, sure. I mean, when I was writing the book, I was in a much more apocalyptic frame of mind than I am now. I guess I was conceiving it and thinking about it a lot in the early 80s, around the time that the Iranians had taken the Americans prisoner, and I had babies and very young children at home, and I was in a much more apocalyptic mood. And so, yes, I was consciously saying to people, watch out, and there's a way in which conflict can get out of hand and everything can end, and we don't want it to end.
So, from the writer of The Greenlanders to the readers of The Greenlanders, what do we need to learn? Or is that too big of a question? It must have floated through your mind when you were writing.
Oh, sure. I guess I think that, or maybe what happens in The Greenlanders is that the people who actually bring about the fragmentation of Greenlandic civilization are the protagonists in the book, not the antagonists. And I think that it's very dangerous to perceive one's group as being right or good or victimized by the other group, or by other groups around it. And I think that's what destruction grows out of, the sense of one's own righteousness. And I was just reading, I've been reading Thomas Friedman's book called From Beirut to Jerusalem that I think won the National Book Award last year. And one of the things that he noted about the Israelis that sort of recent date, say, that is true during the 80s, is that as powerful as they are, their leadership perceives themselves as powerless and as surrounded on all sides by powerful enemies, and no amount of objective counting of weapons and arms and military training has convinced them otherwise. So, according to Friedman, the Israelis are much more liable to act aggressively and do harm in this with this sense of powerlessness than they would be if they knew their own power and were able to use it in a responsible way. And I think that's a natural human psychological problem. So maybe in The Greenlanders, what I wanted to do was to show how, with all the good intentions in the world, and even though we like them, the protagonists are the reason that the civilization fragments rather than the antagonists.
Let me reintroduce you to our listeners. We're listening today to Jane Smiley on Conversations. She was educated at Vassar, from which she graduated with her BA in 1971, was at the University of Iowa for her MA, received in 75, and an MFA also in 76 from University of Iowa, took her PhD from that same school in 1978. Her dissertation is a book of short stories called Harms and Fears. The book from which Jane Smiley just read is called The Greenlanders. It is a novel published by Alfred Knopf in 1988. It has been also published in Great Britain, in France, in Sweden, and in Germany, forthcoming in Finland and in Denmark. The Greenlanders by Jane Smiley. You also said in the Publishers Weekly interview I mentioned a bit before that one of the things that drove you to The Greenlanders as a story was that the tiniest of causes can create the most cataclysmic of effects. It seems that also runs through other mm-hmm. contemporary stories of yours. What takes you as a writer to be so taken by cause and effect?
Well, for one thing, it's dramatic. And it forms a very suspenseful structure for a narrative. I guess I first realized this when I was in graduate school and I was reading the Icelandic sagas, which are extremely bare of ornament, but and
pared down.
Pared
you call
down,
them.
Yeah. I mean, they're really remarkable, and the reason that they're remarkable is that the authors really had a very clear view of how small things, how little things led to other little things. And of course, in a feuding society, this would be true, where somebody might one insult to somebody else when they're in a cross-grained mood, and pretty soon you've got whole families of brothers fighting and dying in these arguments. It was a very a society of very touchy people who were very concerned about their own personal dignity. And so, of course, this was directly related to how they saw the world and how they portrayed it in stories. But I also think there's a line in Goodwill, I can't remember where it is now, where the father is kind of marveling at what we know about cause and effect at the end of the 20th century, the way the threads of cause and effect seem to lead everywhere. And I think that's been the great unsung change in our worldview by the end of the 20th century, is that so much is known about the heretofore invisible ends of chains of cause and effect, you know, so that we suspect causal relationships everywhere and we think about them all the time, you know. If I drink tap water, or if I, you know, if my car idles in a traffic jam and I'm breathing the fumes of the car ahead of me for an hour, and then will I get lung cancer 20 years down the road, you know? And in some ways, for me, this is a burden to live with, but it's also kind of an interesting thing to explore in my work. And clearly any narrative, any novel or novella is really motivated, or let's say cause and effect is the engine, mm-hmm. any murder mystery, anything like that. So I am interested in that. And
it's particularly interesting to me, the story that you just mentioned, Goodwill. Bob Miller sets out to educate his son into a life and to a set of values that Bob respects. He's literally gone back to the land. He earns about $300 a year and can tell you to mm-hmm. the penny how much that is, and everything else is handmade, homemade, bartered for, taken from the land or from other people's toss-outs. And of course his son, who is educated to grow in this responsible and responsive mode, all of a sudden takes a left turn and begins to do what is for the community and for Bob horrifying acts. So cause and effect sometimes has its mysteries.
Well, I don't know that it is a mystery. I mean,
to Bob,
it is. But it ceases to be. I think he comes to understand that it's isolation itself. The son's dissatisfaction with his life, whether which might not even be conscious. I don't think Bob ever knows if it's conscious or not. Manifests itself by destructive acts against a black child who turns up in his school, in a previously all-white school. And I think Bob realizes, as the reader does, that it's isolation that has not given the child his racist thoughts, but given the child the ignorance of the world that combined with his anger at his family, you know, this is a conduit, this is a way that all of his anger, this is a direction that his anger can run toward that is somewhat socially mm-hmm. acceptable. And I think that's true in America, that we often see a pattern of anger in white people that then finds its way toward other groups and turns into, or congeals, you might say, into hatred of those other groups.
Those who are different, those who are not like me, they have it easier or better or don't know how good they have it or...
Or they're on, you know, or they get something I don't. Right. One of the things that I think about fairly often, we have a house in northern Wisconsin where there's been a lot of controversy between the Native Americans, the Chippewa, and the whites about spear fishing. And what sticks in the craw of the white fishermen is the principle that the Chippewa are getting something that the white fishermen aren't getting. And they don't remember that the Chippewa have lost so much. You know, they don't account for it in any way. They just say to themselves, they're getting something extra.
That's not fair.
And it's not fair. And so it's, so these people these men in northern Wisconsin act in what appears to be a racist way to outsiders towards the Native Americans there. But what they don't feel racist. They feel that there's just an unfair thing going on and they want it to be fair. So it's obviously in our society, it's a terrible, knotty problem that can only... And I happen to think that these problems are only solved by becoming educated about other points of view. And I think actually that's exactly what novels and short stories are for. That once you've read, once one of these... men in Wisconsin, you know, if he could go and read 10 novels by Native American writers about life on the reservation and what it means to grow up as a Native American in this country, then maybe he would stop before he went out onto the dock the next time and shouted hateful slogans. But, you know, I believe in this. I guess that's why I do it.
Yeah. When you write in order to educate, in order to expose the closed mind to a window, do you do so purposefully in an objective tone? Now, I ask this based on an assumption, but I read a review of Ordinary Love and Goodwill in which the reviewer clearly did not see things objectively. I don't remember if it was a man or a woman, but he or she said that that Ordinary Love story lead character Rachel was self-indulgent, and that by the end of Goodwill, the sexless character Bob Miller was...
I don't think I've read that story.
Something
that
hung
review.
On his own self-righteousness. And I went back and I looked at both these stories and I thought, but Jane Smiley doesn't see Rachel as self-indulgent. It seems to me that you laid both of these characters out with their problems and their shortcomings and asked us to make the decision, asked us to look at ourselves and look at them.
Well, my experience as a writer, and actually the way I've from talking to other writers, I think often their experience is the same. They're not quite as judgmental of people as others are. And I think it's because any situation presents itself to them first as interesting and second as having moral qualities. And I think a person is innately forgiving of things that interest them. So when I go to write about a situation or a group of characters, I almost never feel judgmental of them. I almost always just feel fascinated by them, and judgment is sort of suspended in my mind. But clearly in having a story work itself out in a certain way, moral judgments come into effect. And I'm often surprised by the response of readers to my characters. For example, I thought that the dentist protagonist in The Age of Grief was really sort of despicable all the way through, because he wasn't, he was trying to protect himself. He was cowardly and self-protective and irresponsible. And he appeals constantly to the reader in a sort of, aren't I charming, aren't I thinking the right thoughts kind of way. And many, many, many readers just loved him. Whereas I thought that Bob, the character in Goodwill, was a much more responsible person who really attempted to take responsibility for what his kid had done and to find a way to stop it. And then when it proved unstoppable, to suffer his punishment, which was a great punishment of losing everything that he owned and joining the mainstream of American life again. So I thought he was I liked him a lot better than the dentist. But so many people have said, oh, they thought he was a prig and just awful from the beginning to the end. And I think in some sense it's his social manner rather than his actions, as he's trying to judge what to do. He both gives himself credit and takes it away. He never is modest. He's never falsely modest. And maybe that comes across as pomposity. But I always laugh when I hear people, mm-hmm. how people respond to my characters, because it just seems so off the wall to me.
Do they walk around in the living room, bedroom, bathroom with you while you're writing them? How much do these people live?
No, they sort of inhabit my head. They live there in that space. The characters of the Greenlanders were with me for a long time, probably until I really got started on my new book, which is now done. So that would be about a year and a half ago, 1989. So the characters in the Greenlanders were actively with me.
Long after they were written.
For 9 or 10 years. But the other characters, in fact, I was at the grocery store one day, and I was standing behind a man in the checkout counter, and I instinctively responded to him as there being something sinister about him, and I stepped back. And then I took a closer look at him and realized that he was Bob. This was after I'd written Goodwill, and that he was dressed the way Bob would be, the way a person who'd bought all his clothes in 1973 and adhered to certain principles and had the same kind of hair and the same kind of mustache. And I thought, boy, I've really changed, because in 1973 I would have thought this guy was incredibly attractive.
Great.
And now I'm instinctively afraid of him, you know. So it's funny where your characters appear.
This is Jane Smiley. Her most recent book is Ordinary Love and Goodwill by Fawcett. Originally published by Alfred Knopf in hardback. The Greenlanders came out in 1988, the opus from which she read earlier, 500-page book about the last days of the original people living in Greenland. A nonfiction work was published in 1987 by Crown and is The Craftspeople of the Catskills. Another book, if you're taking notes, you won't want to forget, is called The Age of Grief. It is a novella about the dentist mentioned a moment ago, and a grouping of short stories, also published in Great Britain, in Spain, and forthcoming in Finland and in Germany.
Oh, it's been published in all those places.
All those since then.
Now.
So this is a little old. Also in Japan. It's a popular book. An earlier book, Duplicate Keys. That was the first novel. Is that right? No, at Paradise
no.
Gate. Yeah,
and then there was Barn Blind too.
Yeah, quite a few.
Duplicate Keys was the first Knopf book. So others like to forget the others, but I like to remember them.
You've written a lot about the family relationships, whether they are intimate, one lover to the other, or nuclear or extended families. I'm intrigued at a time when everyone is pounding the nail in the coffin of the family in the United States, that the family is one of your primary themes. What do you think about the American family?
Well, I think it's sort of come on hard times. I mean, that's one of the things I tried to explore in Ordinary Love, because Rachel, the mother, she's kind of a, what do they call those people who, she's kind of been a groundbreaker. Her marriage ended in 1965, probably 10 years before a lot of American marriages that were to end suddenly ended. And it ended for reasons of dissatisfaction with her spouse and with her life. And the thing that she discovers about herself over the course of the next 20 years and that she acknowledges in the novella is that she was glad it ended. She was glad not to be married. She was happier, even with all the custody hassles. She was happier as a single person than she had been married to that particular man. And I think that's been the experience of a lot of women, that that autonomy with all of its problems is preferable to the kind of faceless existence in a family that some women were subjected to. And yet Rachel has to look back and say that it's been terrible for her children, that they've suffered a great deal. She can't decide if they would have suffered less if she'd stayed married to the father, but clearly the father's profound anger at her has been taken out on the children and has also simply expressed itself in other ways, not pointed at the children, but that have been destructive to the children. And I think that's an important, I think it's important for women and all Americans to think about what the cost of autonomy is. You know, I've been divorced twice. I happen to think the cost is less than the cost of dependency and loss of self and a kind of strict patriarchally oriented family life where all of the conflicts between and dissatisfactions that the parents feel in their relationships with one another are suppressed and kept hidden. I think the costs of that are greater, but clearly children are asked to take on burdens, psychic burdens, that are very difficult for them. And it's important not to deny those too. Just as it was important not to deny that traditional marriage was sometimes horrible. It's also important not to deny that untraditional marriage is sometimes horrible for the children who are no longer as well protected as they once were.
And the base is that if this one life requires us to live our own life fully, then we must take responsibility for the fallout.
Well, yes, I think so. I think we have to judge the cost. Because if we tell our children there was no cost, then we're asking them to deny their own feelings of pain and betrayal. And that's the first step to mental breakdown for them.
Or in perpetuating the aberration.
Right, or whatever. I always think denial is the first step to terrible mental and emotional difficulties. And, okay, but we can't say, okay, I'm going to face up to my feelings, but I'm not going to face up to my children's feelings. I'm going to ask them to deny rather than me denying. So it's clearly a difficult thing. But in my own life, I felt that for the picture, for what the children see about their lives and your lives, to coincide with what they sense and feel about it, that that's the best thing. And even if everything they sense and feel isn't positive, at least they have some basis for thinking that it's true and real rather than some kind of false front. So there are many people who are very, who feel that, oh, the American family is dead and it's hopeless and it's all the fault of women and that everything is going to be worse and worse and worse. But I don't necessarily know that that's true. I think that the results aren't all in yet.
We've probably got 5 minutes left, give or take. Can you give us a look at the novel just finished?
Sure. I mean, that's another novel about a terrible, terrible family. This is a truly terrible family. And maybe it's, I view it as truly terrible because not only a traditional patriarchal family, but a pathologically patriarchal family where the daughters are subservient to the father until he's deep in his old age, and then when he abdicates some of the ownership of their property, they begin sort of throwing off everything, throwing off all their restraints, and he begins also perceiving, since he's no longer the boss, he begins perceiving now that he's the victim. And this is a dysfunctional family to end all dysfunctional families. And they happen to live on a farm. It takes place on a farm in northern Iowa.
Present time?
1979, at the height of the farm boom. And so a lot of what the novel's about is sort of how the father's sense of the ownership of the daughters and the ownership of the farm lead him to destroy both.
And a title?
It's called 1,000 Acres.
Publishing company?
Knopf. It should be out in November.
November. 1,000 Acres, coming out in November by Jane Smiley. Take a look for these other books, please. They're worth your time. Ordinary Love and Goodwill, 2 novellas, published by Fawcett in paper. The Age of Grief, a novella, and then a fine compilation of short stories of love, marriage, and friendship. Please look out for Jeffrey, Believe Me. It is a very fine little story, also by Jane Smiley within that collection. And The Greenlanders, which came out in 1988, a novel also by Knopf. There are more. Look back in the history and you will find them. Jane Smiley, it's been a pleasure talking to you today.
Thanks.
This has been Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. See you again next week.